This is Pastor John Barnett inviting you to come and take advantage of our website. All of the messages that I teach are available free of charge for you to listen to over your computer or to download the actual study notes that I share with the dear saints at Tulsa Bible Church. Our website is called discoverthebook.org. That's discoverthebook with no spaces, .org. Let's open in our Bibles this morning to the book of 2 Peter chapter 3. On our way to Genesis, we're looking this morning at the world that perished in the Genesis flood. Now, there is an entire army of people in our world today who are committed to dispelling the notion that the whole world perished in the Genesis flood, like it says in 2 Peter 3. You say, who would those people be? Well, there's literally hundreds of thousands of them. Many of them are educators who, throughout the education system of the universities around the world, systematically debunk the idea that there was a global deluge, a flood. The rest of them are scientists who spend their life trying to overlook the fact of what's going to be on the Discovery Channel in just 2 weeks. Did you know they found an entire mammoth that weighs 15,000 pounds? It is so fresh, you could cut it and grill it on your grill this afternoon, and it would be perfect steak. And when they cut it open, they found inside of its stomach perfect yellow buttercups, little flowers it had eaten. Scientists looked at that thing and they said the only way a 15,000-pound elephant could be frozen that quick to preserve what's in its stomach is that it was put into a freezer 150 degrees below zero. Now, where on earth could you get a freezer like that? One place. At the climactic moment that God ruptured the surface of the earth, let the fountains of the deep break loose, and the Genesis flood occurred, and geysers, literally, went up 20 miles into the air of superheated water that exploded and came down in ice on the earth. Amazing stuff. You say, where's all that? Well, look at 2 Peter chapter 3. It says this, and saying, verse 4, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. Verse 5, for this they willfully forget that by the word of God the heavens were of old, the earth standing out of water and in the water. Now look, here's the title of our series. By which the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. The world that perished in the Genesis flood. Well, let's go to that world, back to Genesis chapter 6. And this morning we're going to, in a few moments, read together the first 8 verses of chapter 6. But the fact that the entire world perished in the Genesis flood has been scoffed about for thousands of years, like we just read Peter's words. Even today, there are men and women, scientists and educators, who systematically deny that there was a global flood of Noah, as described in the Bible. What is that they're trying to dispel? They're trying to erase God's compelling testimony. His compelling testimony of global death through a catastrophic flood. And God has placed on every continent, across every land, under every seabed, a vivid record that there's a global flood that hit this earth. You know why God put that there? He said, I destroyed the earth once with water, I'm going to destroy it a second time with fire. It's a warning. Every time you see a little vestige of the Genesis flood, it's a reminder that the same God who killed every living human being on this planet except for 8 out of perhaps billions, he says, I'm going to do it again. Did you know there was room in the ark for everybody that would respond to God? And only 8 would out of the whole planet. Well, last time we were together in Genesis, we started a series on the world that perished in the Genesis flood. This series is an investigation of the 6 fundamental truths about the world that perished in that flood. What are those truths? Well, last time, in our first message, we saw that the world that perished in the flood described in Genesis was a world that, number one, had no time for God. Remember Methuselah? He always wanted to get around to spending time with God and never had time for God. And that's what we studied last time. This morning, we'll find that the world that perished in the Genesis flood Secondly, had no regard for their Creator. You say, what do you mean by that? Well, I'm going to describe it this way. The planet Earth, we'll see this morning, was absolutely flourishing with life. In fact, the words of Genesis are so amazing. Before hypertext links and before bold keys and all the different fonts we have today and flashing video graphics, do you know what the Hebrews used to emphasize things? They would say the word twice. If they said hot, they'd say hot, hot. If they said cold, they'd say cold, cold. And when God said He created the earth full of life, He said, swarm, swarm. In other words, the earth was swarming, swarming with life. And the fossil record shows us that. There is not life present on the planet today that parallels what was going on before the flood. And we'll see that in just a moment. It's amazing. Secondly, not only did they not regard their Creator because of this flourishing life, but we'll see that this entire planet was teeming with plant, animal, and human population explosions, and the whole time, evil was intensifying. In fact, evil got so terrible that a world that had no time for God soon lost all respect, all regard, and all acknowledgement of their Creator. And so they became completely depraved. In fact, we'll see completely demonized. Well, next time we're going to look at the world that perished and see that there was no man like Noah. And this biographical study of the life of Noah will be an amazing time. We analyze what made him a hero of the faith and how he saved his family. Now, there's something that ought to catch your attention. Noah raised his family, and his three sons and their wives triumphed in righteousness through the worst time the world's ever been. It has not gotten as bad as it was then. God says every imagination of every heart on the planet, except for Noah's family, were evil continually. It's not that way now. I mean, I don't see every single person in Tulsa just wickedly intent on murdering and killing and committing immorality, and you don't either. The world is not as bad as in the day of Noah. And he preserved his family through it. We're going to look at those elements. Then we'll see that the world that perished in Genesis, fourthly, had no testimony more vivid than the ark. Can you imagine? The world knew about that huge box sitting in the back of Noah's home, and the world watched a river of animals marching two by two from every corner of the globe. That was kind of hard to miss. I mean, can you imagine if you got up this morning and you saw two elephants walking by your development beside each other, you know, just walking, and behind them a couple of rhinos walking right behind them, and then seven pairs of bighorn sheep, you know, just, and they're all just walking straight toward old Noah's house. I mean, a river of animals coming, migrating from every corner of the planet in little pairs. I mean, that was pretty hard to miss. And yet the hardness of the whole world's heart was they missed the message and they refused to even listen. Then fifthly in the series, we'll see that the world that perished in the Genesis flood had no escape from God's wrath. See, the parallels are striking. The parallel of the ark is Jesus was the ark. And Jesus came and did everything that no one else could do, and yet the whole world wouldn't listen to him when he was here walking on the planet. Well, the parallel to no escape of the flood is that no one can escape God's wrath. And if you think about this, the chilling scenes that took place after God shut the door of the ark, as it began to rain, as volcanoes began to break forth, as geysers began to spurt, the smoke, the storms, the frantic rushing to ever-diminishing higher ground, and then the final moments of life on planet Earth as men and beasts crowded to the very top of the hills and were cut off from breath as the raging waters buried them. That's why anybody that knows anything about the fossil record knows that the mountains are covered with swarms of animals all on top of each other as they all tried to get to the high ground to keep their little snouts out of the water. And they were crushed and buried and killed, piled on top of each other, on top of mountains. Amazing. What a chilling thought. And finally, we'll see that there was no event more catastrophic than the flood of Noah. It totally transformed our world. Well, that's where we're going. Let's look this morning at chapter 6 of Genesis, and we're going to read together the first 8 verses. Let's stand together as we read God's Word, and let's ask God to open our hearts. to his word. You follow along. I'll read Genesis 6, 1 through 8. It says this, "Now it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. Then the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants on earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart were only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. And here's the first mention of grace in the Bible, verse 8. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And so everyone who will ever be saved, likewise also with Noah, will find grace in the eyes of the Lord. Let's bow before our Lord. We bow before you, O Lord, with those words echoing in our heart that every imagination of every heart on this planet was evil continually, except for that man, his wife, his children, and their wives, who responded to your grace. We want to respond and live in our sin-darkened world, holding forth your word like Noah and his family did. I pray that you'd teach us this morning how truly great thou art, O God. In Jesus' name we ask it. Amen. And you may be seated. And as you're seated, I want you to back up to chapter 1 of Genesis with me, because I want to do a running start. Because I want you to look again at Creation Week and be reminded about the testimony that the world had that got flooded in the Genesis flood, the world that perished, what it was they were ignoring. And what an indisputable record God had placed before them. Number one, in verses 9 through 13 of chapter 1 of Genesis, God had created the earth flourishing with plants. God created a planet that flourished with plants. The power of growth, even to this day, is astounding. In fact, a kernel of corn today, not back in Genesis, but today, after all the effects of the fall, a kernel of corn, one seed planted to this year, at the end of the year, if you took every piece of corn off every cob that was on that stalk of corn and replanted it the second year, and then gathered every piece that came from that, on the third year, if you caught what I mean, one grain of corn, planted, the stalk that grows, harvest it all, plant every one of those, let them come up, and take all those and plant every one of those, the product after the third year would be enough to feed the entire United States. You say, how? Well, you know what? We don't realize how multiplying corn and other seed objects are. And that's why in America, we lead the world in agronomy, because the power of growth is so great. One sunflower seed can produce 4,000 more if you have an absolute, complete, perfect crop. Of course, we don't, and that's the problem. But back then, they must have had it. And that is the power of this earth. Do you ever wonder what kind of plants were around during the time of the flood? Well, scientists have found that the earth had oaks and willows and magnolias and sassafras and palms, but they were totally different than they are now. See, what do you mean by that? Well, for example, in Lincoln County, Wyoming, they found palm leaves in the fossil record that were 6 to 8 feet wide. Now, how wide are palm fronds? You ever been here on Palm Sunday? They're, you know, if you get a good one, it might be 4 or 5 inches wide. We're talking about palm fronds where the fronds were 6 to 8 feet wide. We're talking about gigantic objects. Even more significantly, if you look at the trillions of tons of vegetation that had to be squashed, leaves, flowers, and everything else, and buried all over the world in the flood, and that's where we got our coal. Every foot of coal represents feet thick of compressed plant remains, and some coal seams are 30 to 40 feet thick. Obviously,
there was a great deal of vegetation on this planet. Scientists have found tropical forests and coal deposits on the bottom of the Earth in Antarctica. They have discovered 90-foot-high plum trees that were quick frozen, and 90-feet-in-height willow trees that were quick frozen. In fact, I was sharing with the elders this morning at our prayer meeting when they discovered oil in Alaska, you know, the great oil fields they found up there. And they sent all of the engineers up there and all the geologists up there. They began drilling through muck, you know, M-U-C-K, muck. And they found every time they drilled up in that tundra, when they hit 1,100 feet, they began hitting perfectly preserved forests with green leaves, frozen under 1,100 to 1,900 feet of muck. And they would pull them out of their oil drilling shafts, and they would look at plum trees that were 90 feet high. You ever seen a 90-foot-high plum tree? They don't grow that high. They break their branches off, and they don't make it much more than just a short tree, 20 feet high. We're talking about 4 to 5 times growth of anything that we know about here. On the New Siberian Islands today, they have 100-foot-high willow trees where only 1-inch-high willows grow today because of the severe cold. Oil prospectors, as I said, drilling through the Alaskan muck, have brought up 18-inch-long chunks of trees from almost 1,000 feet below the surface. They were not petrified. They were frozen. And yet the nearest forests to the upper tundras of Alaska are hundreds of miles away. This is what one geologist wrote. He said, though the ground is frozen for 1,900 feet down from the surface at Prudhoe Bay, everywhere our oil company drilled around this area, we discovered an ancient tropical forest. It was in a frozen state, not in a petrified state, and between the 1,100 and 1,700 feet level, we found palm trees, pine trees, tropical foliage in such profusion that it looked like a forest was growing 2,000 feet under the ground. And what's amazing is they weren't petrified, they were frozen, and many of them, the leaves were still green. 1,900 feet. Now you fit that into the geological table, right, that they teach at all of our schools. Well, look at verse 20 of chapter 1, because that's not all. It says, not only was it full of plants, but God says, let the waters abound with an abundance. Remember I said in Hebrew, the way you emphasize, you say it twice? He said, let it overflow with overflowing. Well, did the seas swarm with fish? Well, listen to this. Water is preeminently the seed of life. There's not a bay or a creek or a shelf or a sound on the face of this planet that does not swarm with life. One drop of ditch water, I mean, where they're building the roads and those stagnant pools that are just all over the place, you just go out and get one drop of ditch water, and that water can hold 500 million microscopic creatures. You say, what does that mean? Well, here's something. One teaspoon of water to one of those creatures would be the size of the Atlantic Ocean to us. One teaspoon. That's how full of life water is. Well, God is truly a God of variety. Inside that little teaspoon of water, 500 million infusoria, these are little microscopic creatures, can live comfortably. In one drop of water can appear 1,000 species of these little creatures in the water. Some are herbivores, some are carnivores, some have shells, some have no shells, some have mouths, teeth, muscles, nerves, glands. In fact, they found some species that have between 1 and 200 sacs or stomachs, all connected by these intestinal canals. And the thickness of the membranes that line their stomachs are 1/50 millionth part of an inch. And yet they multiply after their own kind and swarm through drops of water. Wow. Nowhere on earth today do we have such amounts of fish on the scale we see in the geologic deposits. The herring fossil beds of the Miocene shales of California contain evidence that 1 billion fish died within a 4-square-mile area. And they were just squashed down into a pancake of 4 billion fish, just matted down on top of each other with their skeletons interlocking because they were in such profusion. It's almost like a swarm of fish were out in the ocean and someone just took and went with a fly swatter and just squashed them. And that's what it's like. Another place, the Karoo beds of Africa, contain the remains of 800 billion fish. You say, well, a million fish could be killed in the red tides of the Gulf of Mexico today. That's true. But they don't become fossils. They just rot away and dissipate. Debris from the vegetation mats today all over the world don't become coal. What happened was a cataclysmic event. An event that caused 15,000-pound elephants to be as fresh today as frozen food from the supermarket. That caused there to be vegetation that's still green 1,900 feet underground. That caused there to be 800 billion fish crushed into a pancake that perfectly preserved them as they were swimming through the water, and now they're fossilized. Look at verse 24. Here's another one. Then God said, Genesis 1:24, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to its kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth, each one according to its kind. And it was so. It sounds so simple. But only God, who is infinite, could have worked on such a majestic scale as we see in the skies and such a microscopic scale as we see in the seas. There's no such thing with God as bigness or smallness, because God is infinite. On this sixth day, just before he makes man, God made his final preparation of the earth for man's dominion. He made the vertebrates, the creeping things. And Moses, in verse 24, gives a threefold classification for them. First of all, he says, the bema, the cattle, the four-footed domestic animals, in verse 24. Then the creeping things, the remes. These are creatures that move along the ground, and it means literally swarming swarms. The earth is swarming with swarms of these animals, and then the beasts. And scientists have classified millions of different kinds of animals, more than 800,000 different kinds of insects, and 30,000 kinds of fish, and 9,000 kinds of birds, and 6,000 kinds of reptiles, and 3,000 kinds of amphibians, and 5,000 kinds of mammals. But in all that, did you read the news? Last month in Texas, and right near us, they found the largest dinosaur they've ever found on the surface of this planet. And just one little section of its neck was 27 feet long. And looking at the direction the vertebrae were going, they have calculated that that sauropod was 130 feet long. Big guy. The earth was swarming with these kind of beasts. In fact, dinosaurs range in size from the size of a chicken to 160,000-pound, 80-ton brachiosauri. There are five types of dinosaurs. You learn this in school. The horned ones, the duck-billed, the meat-eaters, the small ones, the big plant eaters. And, of course, those were the ones that got to be over 100 feet long and weighed up to 160,000 pounds. Well, that is all the testimony that God left on this earth. Because when he spoke, he says, I'm going to show my creative power. I'm going to make the earth teem with life. I'm not going to make it kind of crawl out of the mud puddle a little bit at a time and slowly get bigger. He says, I'm just going to fill this thing with life because I'm a God of life. And he filled the earth with life. In fact, there were giant flying reptiles, such as the pterodactyls and the pterodons, who would not be able to fly today in our atmosphere. They needed a heavier atmosphere to get enough air to lift their 40 to 50 foot wingspans. But the heaven and earth of System number one, the pre-flood system, would have made the heavier atmospheric pressure necessary for these huge creatures. Evolutionists say we don't know how they could have flown in our atmosphere, but to us, as creationists, it's not a problem. Because the heaven and earth system one, before the water canopy came down of Noah's day, would have provided the air density for these magnificent monsters to fly. In order to protect their jobs in the evolutionary field, they don't even suggest the global flood of Noah's day as part of their solution. Giganticism, that's these big creatures, was common in the pre-flood heavy atmosphere. In fact, I was sharing with the men last night while we were over at the hospital, I said, wouldn't you not want to drive home in the flood era? Why? Dragonflies that they found had 36-inch wingspans. Can you imagine that hitting your windshield? It'd take you out. I mean, they were like They're like cruise missiles. These are insects, dragonflies with a 36-inch wingspan, great big bodies. Wham! Right into your... Wow. I mean, you know, when a bird hits your car, it scares you, but can you imagine a 3-foot-wide dragonfly with those giant eyes? Rhinoceri were 17 feet high at the shoulder and 30 feet long. I mean, have you been to the zoo lately? We have a little one over there. You know, just let me give you one example real quick. For centuries, you've probably heard stories of these huge frozen carcasses of elephant-like animals called mammoths. As I said, Discovery Channel has been advertising in the newspaper that they're going to be showing how they've got an entirely preserved one that they have taken a helicopter and taken it to a Russian museum, and they're going to film or play the film. But we've heard about these mammoths with their curved tusks, sometimes 13 feet long. They are apparently so fresh-looking that many believe they were simply, and I'm talking about in the old world, they thought they were large moles living underground. In fact, the Russians used to call them ice rats. People thought that when a mammoth surfaced and saw daylight, it would die. In fact, the writings of Dr. Leopold von Schrenk, who was the chief of the Academy of Sciences in Petrograd, which is modern St. Petersburg, wrote this in 1869. There were so many mammoths surfacing in 1869, just after the Civil War here. This is what the head of their Smithsonian Institute said. He's not joking. This is what they thought. The mammoth is a gigantic beast which lives in the depths of the earth. It digs for itself dark pathways. It eats the dirt. This accounts for its corpse being found so fresh and well-preserved in the ground. The animal is still a living one, and their rapid tunneling produces earthquakes. I mean, we're talking about an elephant that's 20 feet high at the shoulder with 13-foot tusks, and they figured that those things were eating dirt and going underground like moles, and sometimes when they came up in the day, they'd die, and they would still be fresh when they found them in the tundra of Siberia. Well, since 1869, at least 10 expeditions have excavated the remains of the extinct mammoth. In fact, most of them were found buried in the permafrost of northern Siberia inside the Arctic Circle, and 6 complete mammoths were found in Alaska. As recently as 1977, 2 complete baby mammoths were found that were between the ages of 6 and 12 months. Complete. I mean, with their 2-foot-long shaggy fur all there, and their tusk and all, complete. Well, after studying all this, the Russians estimated that in one 600-mile stretch of the Arctic coast, more than 5 million mammoths are buried in that region of Siberia. 5 million 20-foot-high elephant things with these great big tusks. In fact, the Russians mined them. In Siberia, one mine the Russians have dug has yielded 20,000 complete ivory tusks. Maybe your piano, you know, tickle the ivory, you might be tickling the mammoths, you know, because they're selling this as ivory. In fact, the Bear Island north of Siberia in the Arctic Ocean has 2 ingredients, an entire island, mammoth remains and sand, but the predominant ingredient is mammoth bones. Animals as large as mammoths require several hundred pounds of food daily. Where did they find all that in Siberia? The earth, as God said, was flourishing with life as we cannot even comprehend. This place was teeming with life, plant life, fish, animals. Well, go back to verse 26 now. And God said, let us make man in our image, chapter 1, verse 26. The last thing God made was mankind. Now, just for a second, I want you to think with me what God did. In fact, if you were going to make a human being and had to go out and get the parts, let me read you the parts you'd need, the ingredients. 58 pounds of oxygen, 50 quarts of water, 2 ounces of salt, 3 pounds of calcium, 24 pounds of carbon, a little chlorine, phosphorus, fat, iron, sulfur, and glycerin. If you brought all these items home, a little dust and some water, and had a do-it-yourself kit for making the human body, those are the ingredients you'd need. Now, all of you do this. We'll do an object lesson. Hold up your thumb like this, like I'm going to fingerprint you, okay? Let me talk to you just about this much of your body, your thumb, okay? Let me see those thumbs. Some of you, come on. Thumb up. There we go. A mere piece of skin the size of a postage stamp on your thumb right here, is made up of 3 million cells, 1 yard of blood vessels. I mean, we're talking about one little square inch of your body. It has 3 feet of blood vessels, 4 yards of nerves, 100 sweat glands. Wow. 15 oil glands, 25 nerve endings. Yet the evolutionists ask us to believe that the blind forces of chance put all that stuff together in that square inch. Amazing. The complexity just... And I'm not talking about everything your thumb can do and how your mind can make it do it without, you know, without even thinking. I'm just talking about the composition of that material. Well, Dr. Mayo, you've heard of his clinic he founded, used to humorously put it this way. He said, if you want to make a body, you have to have enough potassium for one shot of your child's cap gun. You have to have enough fat for 7 bars of soap. Enough iron for one large nail. Enough sulfur to delouse a dog. Enough lime to whitewash a chicken coop. Enough magnesia for a dose of medicine. And enough phosphorus for a few boxes of matches. He said the total purchase would not fill more than 2 grocery bags. And yet God took that dust and he put it together in such a way that we are immortal and have infinite capacity. Well, now to chapter 6 and verse 5, and this is the sad conclusion. So God made man, and when God left man to himself, he crashes. In fact, verse 5 is God's prognosis or diagnosis or his analysis of the 10th generation of humans. Remember, God made Adam. We went through this in chapter 5. Adam, Seth, Enosh, Canaan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, Noah. 10 generations. Look at verse 5. The Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and every intent of the thoughts of his heart. I mean, humans would go out and they would see life just teeming. They would see the complexity. They'd see the diversity. They'd see the symmetry, the order. They'd see the glorious creative fingerprints of God. And it only intensified their evil. They wouldn't regard their Creator. They didn't have any time for him, and they didn't have any care for him at all. So God records the times of Noah as the worst times in human history. And Noah, who had to live through those times, could have thought, wow, I'm handicapped living in a time like this. But instead, he saw it as an opportunity to serve the Lord. And so God called Noah to warn the world, and the only difference between Noah and the world that perished in the Genesis flood was not the amount they knew about God. They all knew about him. They heard rumors about him. Enoch was walking around. Adam lived for half of the time between creation and the flood. Adam was around. He says, hey, look at me. I was made from the hand of God. He was living here. All the patriarchs, those generations that were so close to the creation, they passed on, and yet the world says, we don't want to know about God. And then Noah began preaching his 120-year-long sermon. And he left the world without excuse. But the condition of humanity is much like Charles Haddon Spurgeon said, he who does not believe God will punish sin will not believe that he will pardon it through atoning blood. See, people don't want judgment. Then they don't need blood to redeem them. And so, a God of love is popular even in our day, but a God who judges is not. Spurgeon concluded by saying, I charge you who profess the Lord not to be unbelieving with regard to the terrible threatenings of God to the ungodly. Believe the threat, though it should chill your blood. Believe, though nature shrink from the overwhelming doom. For if you do not believe, disbelieving God at one point will drive you to disbelieve God on the other points of revealed truth. If you don't believe, God flooded the world and destroyed every living creature, human and all animals except those in the ark and those who were able to survive on the floating mats of vegetation. If you don't believe that, then you'll start disbelieving God on other points too. And just as the bright light of Noah's life stood in stark contrast to the sin-blackened hearts of the world that perished in the Genesis flood, so we are to hold forth the light of Christ. For just a moment, turn to the Gospel by Matthew with me, chapter 24, because I want to introduce you to one of the great believers in the flood. His name was Jesus Christ. And in chapter 24, in verse 37, this is what Jesus said. He used Noah as a preaching illustration. And in Matthew 24, 37 to 39, Jesus said, "For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For as in those days which were before the flood, they were eating and drinking and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and they did not understand the flood until the flood came and took them all away, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be." What an amazing moment of sheer terror it will be when unbelievers face the holy God of the universe and realize with absolute certainty they are eternally lost. That must have been the feeling of the people of Noah's day when they saw the floodwaters rising up to their feet and finally to their knees and finally to their heads. And they knew that the door to the ark was unalterably shut. And there was no way to escape the judgment, the horror they must have felt. We live today in a world not at all unlike Noah's. We, like him, see wickedness, immorality, violence, lewdness, vulgarity, profanity, lying, killing, blasphemy, all are rampant then and today. Just as Noah was saved through the flood, so the 144,000 Jews will be preserved through the tribulation. Just as God drew Enoch out of the world before the flood, so we who are alive and remain shall be caught up in the moment in the twinkling of the eye to meet the Lord in the air. All of the pictures correspond with the biblical record. Someone once said, if God doesn't destroy our world, he will have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, the judgment that lies ahead for the earth dwellers on this planet will not be a global flood as Noah saw in Genesis 9, but it will be the fire of God's wrath that Peter saw when I opened our service in 2 Peter 3:10. As Noah learned, so we know today, the only security is in God's ark. And God's ark of security is Jesus Christ. I want to conclude with what Job said. Job 22, Job talked about the flood. In fact, the flood is a big subject. But Job 22:15 says, "Will you keep the old way which wicked men have trod?" Verse 16, "Who were cut down before their time, whose foundations were swept away by the flood." Verse 17, they said to God, "Depart from us. What can the Almighty do to me?" Well, the Almighty can do two things to you. Number one, he can save you. He invites you while the door is open of Jesus Christ to come to the ark of his safety. And if not, he can destroy you eternally.